And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's program is a newly recorded interview with military veteran and best-selling author Dan Hempton talking about his latest book called Vanishing Act. Part two from the morning show archives is one of my all-time favorites, a conversation with David Lipsky about his book Absolutely American, 4 years at West Point. Here's part one of today's show. It's always a very special pleasure to be able to reconnect with as fine a writer as Dan Hempton. He has been a guest on the morning show on a couple of previous occasions, I believe most recently to talk about his wonderful book, Valor, the astonishing World War II saga of one man's defiance and indomitable spirit. His most recent book, published by St. Martin's Press, is called Vanishing Act, the enduring mystery behind the legendary Doolittle Raid over Tokyo. This book examines, first of all, something that quite a few people who know at least a little bit about the Second World War will be acquainted with, namely the daring raids over Tokyo in 1942, an effort by the Allies to make a statement, if nothing else. Not too long after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. But what is not so widely known is an intriguing mystery that Dan Hempton has explored extensively in his new book. And that's what we will focus on for the next few minutes. First of all, Dan Hempton, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, and thanks. It's always a pleasure.
And we should mention that Dan Hempton is more properly introduced as Lieutenant Colonel Dan Hempton, a very experienced combat pilot for the United States Air Force. And so when you write about a story like the Doolittle Raid over Tokyo, you are really able to speak from a particular sort of experience versus the typical author. What kind of a difference does that make in understanding the courage of these particular pilots in this undertaking?
Well, it's really been a tremendous asset because, you know, I flew jet fighters, not piston-driven bombers or you know, World War II aircraft. But, you know, some things never change. And you know, the feeling that you get when you're over enemy territory and people are shooting at you is pretty much the same, whether it was 1942 or 2003. So I can relate to that and the pilots or the people that I write about and put it into words that, you know, we all today can understand and hopefully give readers a little bit of a taste of what that's like. And they seem to love it.
Very much so. So we are talking, as we already talked about, this raid that took place on April 18th, 1942. 16 B-25 bombers that hit targets in and around Tokyo, Japan. In your author's note, you call this something that was, first of all, a gesture of defiance that would show the enemy and also a fence-sitting Soviet Union that America was still in the fight. You mention one other purpose behind this raid on Tokyo, besides just sort of the theatricality, in a sense, of it, this gesture of defiance. But there was also another very practical reason to engage in something like this.
Well, yeah, they from a military standpoint, you don't want to play the other guy's game. And if you can derail his momentum, if you can get him guessing what you're going to do, then the initiative passes from him to you. And that's more important than most folks realize when you're talking about combat. And this was a chance to slow up the Japanese, to make them think. I mean, at this time, they were kind of running wild all over the Pacific, and this was a chance to hit them in their own backyard and to make them maybe pull up and think a bit. There was also the issue with China, because they had invaded part of China, and we were trying to get them to divert more resources away from attacking us in the Pacific and maybe send them to China instead. And then, as you mentioned, there was the Soviet Union, which, you know, as it's not unlikely when you think about Russians, because the Russians have a capacity for duplicity that I think is pretty much unmatched in the world. And they were playing both sides of the fence. They did not want to fight Japan. They were having to fight Germany in the West. They did not want to fight Japan in the East, even though their allies, namely the United States, was already doing that. So this was a chance to, as you said, show everybody what could happen and, in fact, what was coming.
Right. And, of course, it also bought the U.S. military some time to continue to build up their resources in order to face Japan head on. So this mission is put together involving 16 B-25s, and these were vehicles that were ultimately converted, mechanically converted for the task of this mission, or we should say 15 of these 16 planes were converted. Explain what this conversion was all about and why it's important to take note of this when it comes to the mystery of the 16th plane.
Well, this was one of the two clues that set me off at the beginning as you know, thinking that, hey, there had to be something more than this. It wasn't accidental. All the planes were modified to carry more fuel, because that's one reason why the Army was doing it, not the Navy. The Navy didn't have airplanes with the range to hit Japan and then make it to China. But the Army didn't have a way to get them there, so they compromised, which is why you found Army bombers sitting on an aircraft carrier deck. But the bombers still had to be modified. They had to add some fuel tanks. They took out the guns, heavy radios, and things like that. And more importantly, within the engines, they specially modified the carburetors so that they would be more fuel efficient. I was talking like 20 to 40 gallons per hour, which is a lot of fuel when you're talking about a 10-hour mission or so. One of the clues that set me off, though, was the fact that one plane, Plane 8, this plane, had its carburetors remodified back to the original factory standards while they were on their way to California. Now, why would that happen, and why would it be this one plane, right? So that was something that stuck out for me and set me sort of on the hunt, if you will, because there had to be a reason for it, and in fact there was.
Right, exactly. Explain the veil of secrecy that made it difficult to probe into this mystery of why this one plane ended up landing in the Soviet Union. I mean, what kind of silence are we talking about, and to what resources did you have to turn then in order to try to get some answers?
Well, the veil of secrecy at the time obviously was necessary because it was a secret mission. But one thing that, you know, is always kind of startling to people, you know, of our generation who are used to documentation, paper trails, you know, electronic tracks and things like that, is that there wasn't any for this raid. It was all done verbally. You know, Doolittle's part especially was all done verbally. And so the submission, if you will, the mission that this one plane undertook to the Soviet Union was also done verbally, face to face. So there was no written record of it because it didn't exist. You had a lot of anecdotal evidence, and there were a few minor slip-ups in pages and pages of reports that I had to go through. I found a couple of times these guys slipped up and mentioned something that they shouldn't, but it wouldn't really jump out at you unless you were looking for it, which I was. So through the National Archives and through the National Institute of Japanese Defense Studies and some other places, I found enough to piece together what Plane 8 was really up to.
Right. And, of course, people can read your book, Vanishing Act, to kind of probe into some of that, of what was going on. Let's circle back for just a second to this actual raid, because you do spend some time, of course, talking about that as well. And just talk for a moment about what these raids ultimately accomplished in terms of the bombs that were dropped and the difference that it made.
Right. Well, the big purpose, as you said earlier, for the raid was more psychological and morale morale-centric than anything else. 16 medium bombers weren't going to carry enough of a payload to do significant damage, you know, to Japan. But that's significant physical damage. They did, in fact, do quite a lot of psychological damage because, you know, here they are 4 months after Pearl Harbor, running wild, doing what they want, thinking they've got the mighty United States, you know, rocked back on its heels, and all of a sudden these bombers appear at rooftop level over Tokyo and Kyoto and some other cities, Osaka, and drop bombs. I mean, it was very startling. It was very humiliating for the Japanese. And so from that standpoint, the raid was a tremendous success. And one thing that sometimes gets overlooked, one of the consequences of this raid was because of that shock and humiliation, the Japanese were goaded into acting prematurely in their next big operation in the Pacific, which led to the Battle of Midway, which they categorically lost disastrously for them because they lost four of their frontline aircraft carriers and never replaced them. And that was more or less of an indirect result of this raid, because they were so angry and humiliated, they felt like they had to attack us, and that led to their defeat.
One thing you say, interestingly, in the prologue is that this mission could have backfired in several different ways, but as you go on to say, much must be chanced in war. What are the most important ways in which this could have backfired badly for the United States?
Well, if the Japanese had been successful at Midway, and if they had sunk our aircraft carriers as we intended, we were still months, maybe almost a year away from having our own naval production geared up to the point where they could be replaced. And now we would be the ones completely on the defensive. Remember, we're fighting a two-front war here. I mean, on the other side of the globe, we've got the Germans and the Italians to contend with. So we didn't have all the resources at that time to fight both. So it could have backfired that way. It also could have backfired in that the Japanese could have pulled a good portion of their million soldiers they had stationed in China and said, we're going to use these now to sweep through the Pacific and totally wipe out the Americans. They never did that. They were always more afraid of the Russians invading Manchuria, at least through a good part of the war, than they were of us, which was a terrific mistake, because if they'd even devoted a portion of those soldiers to fighting us in the Pacific, you know, our victories at Guadalcanal and other places probably wouldn't have happened.
Well, your book examines not only these Doolittle raids, but of course probes into the mystery of this 16th plane, the one that actually landed in the Soviet Union, and what could possibly have been behind such a mission. We're leaving it to our listeners to read your book to get that question answered. But we should say that those who piloted that plane survived after a year's internment. In fact, explain how that year-long internment in the Soviet Union ended.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I devoted a little bit of time to explaining Russia and the Soviet Union so that people would have some context as to why the Soviets acted the way they did. You know, there was a really good chance that they would have just shot these guys in the head and dropped them in a ditch somewhere. You know, they're Russians. That's what they do. But they were understandably a little bit leery about the United States because we were supplying them with $1 billion worth of equipment. But they did not want to anger the Japanese, which is why they interned these guys. They didn't want to provoke the Japanese into declaring war against them. So that's why these guys were stuck in internment. And they were moved from the maritime province in the far eastern part of the Soviet Union several thousand miles all the way through, you know, Mongolia and the deepest part of Russia, more or less to the center of the Soviet Union. And they were held there for, like I said, over a year before they were finally moved inexplicably very far to the south near the Iranian border. And they were basically allowed to escape. They were set up so they could escape, so Stalin could then shrug his shoulders and say, hey, we didn't let them go, they escaped. But he wanted them out by that time, and so he gave them the opportunity to make it out, and they did.
Well, that's just one aspect of a complex and fascinating story probed in this very interesting new book called Vanishing Act, The Enduring Mystery Behind the Legendary Doolittle Raid Over Tokyo, published by St. Martin's Press, and the author, Dan Hampton. Dan Hampton, congrats on yet another fascinating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. It was great to reconnect with you.
My pleasure, Greg. Thanks, as always.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. We are visiting West Point today, courtesy of author David Lipsky, the author of a book called Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. This is a very interesting project that really took years to formulate, because David Lipsky was on site at West Point, not as a student, but as a very interested observer over the course of 4 years. And his observations are recorded beautifully in this book, which is really quite thought-provoking in many ways. He is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone and has written for a number of publications. He's a novelist as well, an award-winning author many times over, and we're grateful that we have David Lipsky for a few minutes to talk with us about his book, Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. David Lipsky, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, Greg, it's great to be on.
Tell us a little bit, as you explain in, I think, the preface of the introduction, how this project sort of ballooned from a one-shot magazine thing into a more of an epic canvas.
Well, it's kind of a two-part story. The academy, the military academy of West Point, which is about 50 miles north of New York City, they were very afraid in the later 90s they were being forgotten. And the reason why they had that thought, I mean, it's a fear the Army has whenever there's a long peacetime, essentially. The reason they had that thought was that the two generals who run West Point were going to a Denny's, and they were driving to, actually, a conference of many other generals. And they were wearing their Class B uniform, and they were wearing the ribbons, which are called fruit salad in the Army, because they're, you know, they're red, white, and yellow, and green stuff. And they had pulled in, and when they were standing, kind of, when they were walking to the foyer, the hostess turned around, saw these guys in uniform, got a huge grin on her face, walked over, shook their hands, and said, "I just want to thank you, fine gentlemen, for the great work you do on behalf of the U.S. Parks Department." And I think that really made them think, hey, we have to get reporters up here fast.
They seemed relatively open to the idea of you being there for such an extended period of time. Tell us about that invitation to be so present and to be able to capture such a candid, probing view of West Point.
Well, yeah. Again, Greg, I don't know what the feelings of your listeners are towards the military. Mine were pretty negative to begin with. So when Jan Wenner, who's the owner and editor of Rolling Stone magazine, said, "Dave, we're sending someone to Rolling Stone, and you, because you're our college expert, you're drafted," I said I didn't want to do it, because when I grew up, my father took my brother and I aside. I think I was 8, my brother was 10, and said, "Look, you guys can do any job in the world you want except be in the military, and if I ever hear either of you have joined up, I'm going to hire some guys to find you and come break your legs." So, I mean, he just did, you know, he was a young guy during Vietnam and just didn't trust the military. So, you know, my first thought when I heard that I had to get involved with the military for this story was, I don't want my legs broken. So, and also, I just spent my life hearing kind of bad things about the Army. So I really desperately wanted to not do the story. When I got to West Point, what they do generally when you're doing a story about the Army, and certainly about West Point, is you go there for about 4 or 5 days at the most, usually for a day or two, and they escort you. You know, they pick who you can talk to. They kind of prearrange the questions. You're only talking to the best cadets, and then they sit in on the interviews to make sure nothing surprising or even interesting kind of gets said. And then around West Point, you know, as they're kind of walking you to the class, the one class they want you to see, or to the one you know, the one cadet they want you to talk to. There are these little chain kind of fences hanging over the entryways, and there are signs on those that say, authorized personnel only beyond this point. And, of course, beyond that point, it's everything cool that happens at West Point. And so I said, you know, look, I would love to write about your academy. It seems like it's great, but I really can't do a story under these circumstances. The only way I could do it is if I could cross over those fences, you know, if I could be here for as long as I want to, have the right to talk to anybody I want to, and not have anyone kind of chaperoning me at all. You know, I'd like to do this as if I were living as a cadet. And I was so sure they'd say, no, I just went home the next day. And they called me a few days later and said, yes, you can do it. And I just had wanted to go home, so I said, you know, do what? And they said, you can come up here for the 4 years if you want to. You can live like a cadet. And the reason why is because we have nothing of which we should be ashamed, which was such a cool thing to say and such a brave thing to say about a place, but I kind of knew that maybe I had to open my eyes more.
Do you have any sense that a hard and fervent debate took place around the question of whether or not to give you this access? I mean, you obviously weren't present for any of those discussions, presumably behind closed doors, but at any point in your experience, were you given any insight into that?
You know, I was a little bit. I believe that there was one colonel named Colonel Domchek who has, the command structure gave him kind of the most day-to-day control over the lives of the cadets. And I think the idea was that, look, this guy, you know, I think he'll be honest and, you know, if it was a reporter coming from National Review or the Weekly Standard, which are both conservative magazines, and we gave them, you know, access for a few weeks and they said West Point was great, that wouldn't matter as much. But if we give this guy a chance to really see everything, and I heard in these conversations that the phrase was warts and all, that it would mean a lot if he said it was good. And, you know, and that they had, as I understood, they had so much faith in kind of what they were doing there that they knew that there were warts, but the warts weren't covering totally the skin of what really was a great place.
Take us into your experience in sort of living as a cadet for 4 years at West Point. You obviously were not a cadet, in fact, but how close did you come to that experience, or in what way did you live your life during those 4 years?
Well, it's on their schedule. You know, they start the day at 10 of 7, which is 06:50. And that's morning formation. Then they have formation again at lunch. And then they have classes all day. And then in the afternoon they do drills. And then during the summers particularly, they go out and do military training. And I was there doing all that stuff with them. I mean, the joke became, by the end, I followed the class of 2002 from when they arrived in 1998 to when they left June 1st, 2002. And the gag was that I was the one member of the class who was not being commissioned in the Army as a lieutenant.
So you literally were doing all of these things.
Not the homework. You know, I'd already gone through, I'd done 4 years of college before and didn't want to do that much, didn't want to do the tests and the grading and stuff again. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, you know, it was fun stuff to do.
I'm really struck by something then. I mean, I read your book. I think that will be evident through the interview, but I really didn't realize that you were out there working up a sweat with all of these guys. I pictured you right in there, but holding a clipboard or a tape recorder or something and doing the work of a journalist. You really have not put yourself personally into this book very much. It's as though that was a conscious decision that this book not be about what it was like for David Lipsky to live for 4 years at West Point.
Well, yeah, it's funny. I think to be a writer, you have to have some kind of strong egotism, but a real, also healthy mix of reality. And I don't think anybody would have wanted to read a book called Absolutely David, nor would I have wanted to read it. But I did think it was such a great idea. I mean, it was a great chance. West Point had never done that. I don't think any school had ever let someone go through 4 years that way. You have this very cool, mythic place that's been around for 200 years that people know about but don't know at all from the inside. And I thought, just go inside as far as you can. What was funny also, Greg, about that was that, you know, for the military stuff, I was doing it also for fun. I mean, if someone says, hey, you're on the bayonet course, you know, do you want to grab one of the bayonets and go through, which is, it was actually a very, very hard course, the bayonet obstacle course. I used to, because it's a great experience, but it meant a lot to the cadets, not just the cadets I was living with every day, but to the 4,000 cadets there, that they saw I really wanted to get the experience as much as I could. And that made people so much more willing to tell me the truth of their experience, because if you're with a reporter and the reporter kind of wants to be there and kind of doesn't, why should you kind of tell them the whole truth or not just a half truth?
Hmm.
When they saw I wanted to be of the place, then they wanted to give me the experience of the place. So it ended up being great for the book.
Some of the most incredible passages in this book talk about the physical rigors which these cadets...
I know, you know why.
Yeah, well, I guess you were tasting that firsthand. Were you prepared physically for the kind of challenges that were going to face you then in doing some of this stuff with the cadets?
You know, not at first, because I remember originally, Greg, I was going up there, I thought, for a week, you know, so... No, and I went back at the end of my first summer. Again, most of the military training is in the summers because it is, you do get a college degree while you're there, too. So that means from September until June, you are taking academic classes along with some military classes. I went to a cocktail party, which is what as you imagine, everyone, it's the one thing I got right when I was imagining what the literary life was like when I was a kid. There are more cocktail parties than I know I'd be comfortable with. Another writer who I knew came up to me and said, wow, you know, obviously we have to take every writer from New York and send them to West Point because I've never seen you looking this healthy.
We're speaking with David Lipsky. He's the author of Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. Early in the book, you try to paint a picture of what you already touched on as we started our conversation, talking about how West Point felt it was necessary for them to have a higher profile. You cite some very interesting statistics which embody something that you call, or what the military calls, I think, the culture gap.
Culture gap, yeah.
In terms of the numbers of Americans that have any inkling of what the military life is like. Tell us what those statistics look like and what it means for a place like West Point.
Well, I think at the end of World War II, it was something like one in every 30 people. Yeah, I should grab the book, but
actually, in front of me, it looks like by the end of World War II, 1 in 10.
And 1 in 10, and then by the 90s, it was 1 in 300 were serving in uniform, which meant that people really didn't know. I mean, if you 1945, even by 1965, you know, most people reluctantly by then, you know, you knew someone who'd been in the Army. You could talk to someone who'd been in the Army. You knew what the Army did. You were watching the Army on TV. You had a sense this was part of everyone's life, and it was something to think about, something to know about. But I think after the draft came in 75, it was the feeling, and that the reason why the military used the culture gap, is it was as if military culture and civilian culture were friends who had, you know, shaken hands, kind of exchanged phone numbers, and then just started losing track of each other. You know, and there was this sense that people just knew there were bunches of men and women who were wearing green and going to places. But when they would turn on the TV and see a newscast from Bosnia or Kosovo, they would think, there's an Army person. You know, there's that helmet, there's those fatigues, and there's an Army officer, there's an Army soldier. But they wouldn't think, that's my neighbor, that's us.
Hmm.
And that's dangerous, I think, for a country.
It was also interesting for you to explain to us the effect of that incredible film from 1998, Saving Private Ryan, and the way that it affected West Point versus maybe the population as a whole.
Yeah, I'll tell you a great thing about that. What Greg is saying was one of the real first big surprises, because I saw that. I think I refer to that movie early in the book as having inspired a great deal of bystander patriotism, which is everybody thinks, hey, it's great that people are willing to serve and fight for their country. But at West Point, the summer that movie came out, a lot of people began withdrawing their applications because parents and kids had not really thought about how, I guess, how extreme fighting can be, and they didn't want to be a part of West Point. Now, if you cut ahead, you do a smash cut to 2002, 2001, after 9/11, applications have gone up because people now see they have a chance to fight for their country. And, in fact, Princeton Review does those rankings of colleges every year, and the rankings that are being released this fall show West Point is now the hardest place in the country to get into, harder than Harvard, harder than Yale, harder than Princeton, because these cadets and their families want to have the opportunity to serve the country in a really serious way.
Hmm. You call the West Point entering class a high school all-star team. Hmm. I mean, these are really high-caliber young people that we're talking about.
Yeah, it'd be very fun. I never got to see this, because there was always other stuff to cover, but you've got about 50,000 people beginning the process of applying to West Point, and then by the end, about 14,000 people finally fill out the application, and these are like the best people in every school, right? It's the the wrestling team captain versus the debate captain, you know, versus the head of the chess team versus the valedictorian. And I used to imagine it's like one big cage match of all these application files, and it would have been kind of fun to be in the officials office and seeing record against record.
I think it is especially fascinating for us to read about the experience of the first-year cadets who are known as plebes. And one of the things that you talk about and really give us in some really fascinating detail is that process where they get, in your words, soldierized, and where so much of their outside life and past life is both figuratively and literally stripped away. Tell us about that experience with plebes.
That's our day, and it's generally the last Thursday of every June when the new class comes in. And, you know, the book is the decision I made also about how to tell this story and the reason why I'm not really a character in the book at all is it's stories. And I picked like three or four characters, real people, cadets to follow through all 4 years. And we see how this has changed them and how they start out. And they all have nicknames, like the guy on the cover whose real name is Reed Finn. His actual name is, you know, his West Point name is Huck Finn, because they take so much away from you on that first day, our day. They even take away your name for the whole first year that you're at West Point, from that June 27th or June 28th until the following April when you're promoted. You can't use your first name. They want you to know you've left civilian life behind. And so if your name is Reed Finn, your last name is Finn, and you're from Backwoods, Louisiana, you know, if you're a gambling man, you're going to say, hey, my name's probably going to be Huck Finn. So you lose your name instantly. You say goodbye to your parents. You're standing with your parents in a bleacher with 40 other sets of parents. And the officer who's giving you an address says, you have 90 seconds to prepare your final goodbye. Then you go into another room. You turn over all of your clothing that you brought. And you're given a bag, essentially, of underwear and socks. And that's how you're starting your new life. Then you go into another room, take off your clothes, put these clothes on. Also some gym shirts, so you're presentable in shorts. And if you have tattoos, you actually are called over. And they take pictures of your skin, because they kind of now have your skin. Then you, at this point, you've also turned over any medication you brought with you, like aspirin and athlete's foot powder. Then you go to another place. You turn over your hair. You get kind of a buzz cut. And then when you've just been reduced, you give everything over during this. You take an oath saying you're going to serve there for 4 years and then 5 years in the military afterwards. And then when you've given over everything from your old life at that point, then they bring you to a big square, and you have to report to West Point for the first time. You have to say a single sentence. And that sentence is, new cadet Doe reports for the first time to the cadet in the red sash as ordered. And you cannot step into West Point and see your barracks until you get this one sentence right. And it's so difficult when all these other things have happened to you during a day to say it, that actually people from the town will come out and watch this process. So some cadets, it takes hours.
Well, right. You take us through that. We turn page after page after page of hapless cadets that either can't get the words right, or they have not walked up to the correct line drawn in the sand.
Greg, are you a Seinfeld fan at all?
A little bit.
I kept thinking of the soup, that thing with the soup Nazi.
Yes.
You really can't get the phrase. It's great fun. It's a part of the book that people always ask me about, because and then This American Life, you know, we use the tapes from that day, because it's just so funny hearing these people who really are the best, had been the most promising students in all their high schools, floundering and just saying a single sentence.
Right.
That's what their lives have come down to at that point.
You mentioned how, although officially what is taught at West Point and the way in which they are ranked is academic, military, and physical, but those all come together in the building of character more than anything. But you say something so interesting in explaining all of this, of how even this arduous first day is part of that character building experience. You say the process of character building is designed to be exhausting, and when it is not exhausting,
this is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Wrong. And so you get this instinctive sense of kind of where you are, who's around you, because if there's an officer around you, of course, you're going to stand a little taller and hold your chin a little higher. And you're also going to be aware of how your shoes look and how your uniform looks and even what you're talking about. And soldiers have to have that because they have to have a real sense when they're out in the field as to whether they're carrying the right amount of ammo, you know, how much noise they're making, what noise is around them, you know, what's flying overhead, what might be moving in the trees nearby. And situational awareness is just a great thing to have, you know, when you're going into a meeting or when you're walking on the street. So that's, aside from just building character, it makes you aware of who you are and what you're doing at all times. It's kind of a great way. It's like a spider sense.
Hmm. One thing that you talk about in terms of day-to-day life in a place like West Point, you say that it is designed around a sort of fanatical male efficiency, that nearly every detail, down to the tiniest detail in this kind of life, is designed for efficiency, right down to the reason there are standard uniforms, which a plebe wears every single day.
Plebes, and I mean, but basically all the classes wear them every day. You're what you wear to jog in, what you wear to go to the West Point gym, that's a uniform. I mean, you have to wear Army shorts and a West Point Gym Alpha shirt. I think it gets you, again, it raises situational awareness. It gets you used to making the smartest, swiftest choice about things. The very cool thing for me about this book is that I assumed it was one reason, again, why I tried to get out of the story by making this absurd request for total and endless access, right? I assumed that only kids who were destined for this from the start would be willing to go there and would be able to put up with the way it is, right, with the way life is there. And that only people who were really had great character and were very honorable from the beginning could be the kind of people who could, you know, thrive at West Point. I was totally wrong about that. I mean, the main characters in this book, and they all become great kids, great officers. And the kids I met there were normal kids who were a little bit smarter. And as one kid who's like a great kid with a soprano-style accent from Long Island, he just said that when he was 17, 18, he said, I wanted the most radical experience I could think of, and I wanted people to look back when I was 22 and say, yeah, I did something really cool those years. I did something radical. And there were lots of kids like that. And another of the main characters is a sorority girl from Orlando, Florida, named Chrissy Cicerelli, who comes into West Point with a really perfect French manicure and becomes a great soldier and leaves with an even better French manicure. One of my favorite characters, one of the main characters in the book, is a kid named Whitey Herzog.
Yes.
Who becomes, the number 13 ranked militarily cadet in his class of 1,000. And he went to West Point. I mean, he did great there. But he went, when I asked him why he went, he said, Dave, the reason I came here is that I grew up as a deadhead. And I love that my buddies in Buffalo, New York, were the kinds of kids who would, you know, kind of meet, you know, a little bit before the official end of after school. And they would drink beverages they were not the right age to buy out of paper bags in Delaware Park. And I love that my friends were left alone in America. That America is the kind of country where people don't tell you what choices you have to make, even if you're making the wrong choices.
Hmm.
And that's what I wanted to defend. And those are the kind of, the idea that those kinds of people were the people like me who memorized The Simpsons or memorized Eminem lyrics, but could then go on and talk about honor and character.
Hmm.
It was such a great thing to write about that I wanted to stay all 4 years.
You talk about how West Point has changed. However, at one point you quote a West Point officer with saying the joke, West Point represents 200 years of tradition unhampered by progress, which is a great line, but in fact patently untrue. There have been some rather dramatic changes at West Point, changes which I'm sure many or most cadets very much welcome, but some people view with some suspicion that West Point is somehow turning itself into the nice guy army. Tell us about those changes and the misgivings that at least a few veterans might have.
Well, you know, up until 98 when I first got there, and in a sense having a reporter living there was kind of an example of the kind of changes they were taking on. It really didn't change that much over 200 years. You still had people getting up really early in the morning and wearing a uniform and having their social time absolutely circumscribed. I mean, during the first generation of cadets in the 1820s or so, there were rules that there'd be no, you know, after classes were over, there'd be no card playing, no swimming in the river, no novel reading, no play reading, because people circulated play scripts back in the 1820s. And that was what it was like even in the 1920s and 1930s. You didn't have radios, couldn't play your music when you first got there, no TVs, no phones in the barracks, probably the only college where there were no phones in the barracks. You couldn't get on the instant message system and chat with your buddies by computer all night. your buddies from high school. What they were finding was that that was still great for making people live a different way, but it was also making officers who couldn't really connect with the Joes, the soldiers they were leading when they got out in the real army 3 years later, because those people had grown up in the pop culture soup, you know, and they were using references to movies and TV shows the cadets weren't seeing. And so this decision was made in about 97, 98, when General John Abizaz, who now took over Tommy Franks' job as head of CENTCOM over in Iraq, he came in and really said, hey, we're gonna change it. We're going to bring the place into the modern world all in one big jump and bring all those things into the rooms. It was great. It was like watching a town, like one of those stories was a forgotten town that's still 1920 or 1930, watching it come into 1998 and 2000 all at once. It also does make some of the older grads a little bit nervous. The phrase they have, the Army is a world of abbreviations, and what they want to say is the Corps has gone to hell, but what they just say is the Corps has, and that's short for that. They were afraid it was getting soft and it was being a little bit too easy, but I would invite anybody who thinks West Point is too easy to go up there and spend even just a day.
Hmm. One of the things that you touch on in the book is the fact that the world is changing and that we do not live in a world where conventional warfare occurs all that often, and that often soldiers are deployed now in peacemaking rather than war-making situations where a whole array of challenges face them that can be, well, really quite difficult and where an old curriculum might not really be appropriate.
No, that's exactly right. And there's been, you know, again, some of the old grads who want to keep the place as 200 years of tradition without progress are leery of that. But we're seeing the same thing in Iraq. I mean, we had, you know, 3 weeks of real combat followed by what's now going on 4 months of peacekeeping, and the peacekeeping is harder. And so you want to train cadets who can do both, who know how to fight and tear up the ground and do a great job when there's combat, but who can also be there and administer stuff and keep warring groups from going at each other while they're there, and to establish a peace. So it's more important now even than it was before.
Hmm. You also talk about how West Point has concern about an increasing number of its cadets that end up doing essentially the minimum.
Sure,
I think five and fly, where they put in their time and then they're out of there and back into civilian life. And it's interesting that you are taken into the rooms, into the minds of those at West Point that are really responsible for such things and for trying to change that, to instill in more of the cadets a sense of selfless service over a longer period of time.
Yeah, it's a really hard net. I think it wasn't as hard in the 60s or 50s or 40s, but the culture, you know, I mean, TV is this great carnival of free life, right? I mean, there's cool stuff you can buy, there's beautiful women, there's just an easy life that's being portrayed all the time in all the other media. And these kids are going to West Point where they, you know, they have to wear a uniform, where they have to be in their rooms at 11:30, and then an official lights out at midnight. And they know when they go in the, you know, it's 4 years that are free at West Point, but then you serve 5 years in the military afterwards, no ifs, ands, or buts. And that choice is made for them. And when you're in serving as a lieutenant, you know, if they say you have to go to Korea now, or you're going to Haiti, or you're going to Bosnia, or now you're going to Iraq or Afghanistan, you have no choice. And that is, since one of the basic things America celebrates is choice, that's a hard thing for people to swallow as Americans. And so a lot of them, you know, a lot of them have come, as we all do, from civilian culture. It's very hard to make them unlearn those things. Mm. When they get the chance after 5 years to go back, more and more, until this war started, more and more have been going back. And it's something that stresses a lot of people in the Army, because they're devoting their lives to this kind of great way to live, and they want other people to make the same choice.
You do say that West Point cadets are grand epic complainers, but they were also the happiest among the young people that you visited in 35 different colleges over the years. You saw, actually, amidst all the suffering, the bitterness, the complaining, the struggles, the tears, heartbrokenness sometimes, you also saw lots of happiness and a basic goodness among the experience of West Point and its cadets.
That's right. You know, it's funny because my dad, as a good, strong, left-wing Democrat, what he had always talked about, wanting my brother and I to be involved in the kind of life he wanted us to find. and the kind of ideas he wanted us to live by is he wanted to be a country where no gender or race prejudice, right? Where everybody lived together and looked out for each other, where you cared about what you were doing and what the person next to you was doing. And also where people said, hey, I'm doing this job not because I love money, because I love my salary, but because I love the work. And also where everyone tried their hardest for that reason. And, you know, I had never found that just walking around. And I had never found that as a reporter. You know, not just about colleges, but I've written on people who had lots of reasons to be happy, media executives, movie stars, people in government. And there was always a great deal of self, and there was always a great deal of, kind of when you got down to it, basic unhappiness, aside from all the protestations of things that were good in their lives. And then I got to West Point, and that was the world that my father had always talked about. If you were messing up, people would help you at West Point. People really were trying their hardest all the time. And they were doing it, the ones who stay were doing it for love of the work, for love of the country. And that was a great shock to me, that for all the complaining about regulations, you could see they knew what it was like to live a life where you didn't have to wonder if what you're doing mattered to anybody else. And it made them, at the base level, incredibly happy. And what was great about it is that my dad, you know, the book came out about 5 weeks ago. My dad called me the week the book came out, and he apologized. He said, I was wrong, that's a great place. And he thanked me for kind of opening up his eyes to it.
The book is Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point by David Lipsky, published by Houghton Mifflin Company. David Lipsky, I loved this book, and I really appreciated the chance to talk with you about it on the morning show. Thank you for your time.
Oh, it was great being on, Greg. Thanks for having me.
By the way, because I so thoroughly enjoyed speaking with David Lipsky, I immediately asked him if there was any possibility of me calling him back on another day in order for us to continue our conversation. I'm so glad to say that he agreed. And in fact, our second conversation is a little bit longer than the first. If you're interested in hearing the entire conversation with David Lipsky, then I would direct you to the podcast version of The Morning Show, where I am sharing the interview in unabridged fashion. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's coming up on 9 o'clock. Wisconsin Today from Wisconsin Public Radio is coming up next. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.